Elijah received a divine mission that resonated with a breath of change and destiny. The Eternal instructed him with a firm voice, "Return by the way you came, crossing the arid desert to Damascus." There, a special purpose awaited him, to anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat from Abel-Meholah, destined to be his successor in the sacred prophetic journey. The mission was clear. Whoever escapes the sword of Hazael, Jehu will kill, and whoever escapes from Jehu, Elisha will kill. Meanwhile, a revelation emerged. 7,000 souls remained true, refusing to bow before Baal or kiss his image. In the vibrant heart of a field, Elijah found Elisha. 12 pairs of oxen plowed the fertile land, and Elisha, with firm determination, guided one of the teams. In a symbolic gesture, Elijah approached and placed his cloak upon Elisha's shoulders, an unmistakable sign of his prophetic inheritance. Moved by a higher calling, Elisha left the oxen behind, but before following his new mentor, he requested one last farewell. "Let me kiss my father and my mother, then I will follow you." Elijah, sensing the sincerity in Elisha's heart, granted him this grace. "Go back, for what have I done to you?" With a heart full of resolve, Elisha returned, sacrificed the oxen with which he plowed, and with the wood of the plow, prepared a farewell feast for his family and friends. Then, without looking back, he joined Elijah, becoming more than a disciple, a partner in the prophetic journey. As Elijah's time on earth neared its end, a final journey led them to cross the Jordan. From Gilgal to Bethel, destiny called them. Elijah, aware of the nearing end, suggested that Elisha stay behind, but Elisha's response resonated with unwavering faithfulness. "As the Eternal lives, and as you live, I will not leave you." United by a deep spiritual bond, the two continued, with Elisha faithfully following as he contemplated the future that awaited him. In Bethel, the atmosphere was charged with omens and sacred murmurs. The disciples of the prophets, aware of an impending cosmic event, approached Elisha with piercing looks and hushed voices. "Do you know that today the Eternal will take away your master?" With serenity and a heavy heart, Elisha responded, "Yes, I know, but I prefer not to speak of it." The journey continued, and Elijah, moved by a divine call, instructed Elisha once again, "Stay here, for the Eternal has sent me to Jericho." But Elisha's response echoed with the same resolute devotion, "As the Eternal lives, and as you live, I will not leave you." United, master and disciple journeyed to Jericho, facing again the insistence of the disciples of the prophets, who repeated the solemn warning. Elisha, firm in his determination, kept silent, choosing to focus on the presence of his master. The final leg of the journey led them to the Jordan. Elijah, with an almost theatrical gesture, rolled up his cloak, struck the waters, and miraculously the river parted, allowing them both to cross on dry ground. On the opposite bank, as the sacred silence enveloped the air, Elijah turned to Elisha with one final question. "What can I do for you before I am taken away? Ask what you want." Faced with the imminence of parting, Elisha made a request laden with faith and ambition. "I want a double portion of your spirit. I want to be a man of God like you." Elijah, with a penetrating look and a note of solemnity in his voice, acknowledged the greatness of the request. "You have asked a hard thing, but if you see me as I am being taken from you, it will be yours, otherwise not." "I will not leave you," Elisha replied, and so they continued their journey. At that moment, an extraordinary vision split the sky and the earth. A chariot of fire, pulled by horses also engulfed in flames, burst between Elijah and Elisha, separating them in a spectacle of light and energy. Elijah was then taken up to heaven in the midst of a whirlwind, leaving Elisha alone on earth, witness to celestial power. As he watched this miraculous ascension, Elisha couldn't contain his emotion and cried out in deep lament, my father, the chariots and horsemen of Israel." It was a tribute to the strength and impact Elijah had as a spiritual leader. Realizing that the mentor was gone forever, Elisha tore his own cloak into pieces, a traditional gesture of mourning and desolation. Armed with the cloak Elijah had left behind, Elisha approached the banks of the Jordan. With the cloak in hand, a symbol of Elijah's authority and spirit, he confronted the waters. "Where now is the Eternal, the God of Elijah?" he cried out. As he touched the waters with the cloak, the river parted again, and Elisha crossed, solidifying his role as Elijah's legitimate successor. The disciples of the prophets, watching from afar, witnessed the miracle and recognized the transfer of the spiritual mantle. "The spirit of Elijah rests on Elisha," they commented, accepting and respecting Elisha as the new spiritual leader. With enthusiasm, they approached him and offered their service, suggesting to send 50 men to search for Elijah, speculating that perhaps the spirit of the Eternal had taken him to some unexpected place. Initially, Elisha discouraged the search, but in the face of the disciples' insistence, he relented. "Go ahead then." They spent 3 days searching mountains and valleys without finding any sign of the prophet. Upon their return, Elisha confronted them with a mix of rebuke and satisfaction. "Didn't I tell you? Now you believe." On a morning like any other, the leaders of a city, concerned about the well-being of their inhabitants, approached Elisha with an urgent request. The city, despite being well-located and prosperous in appearance, suffered from a serious environmental issue. The river that sustained the community's life was severely polluted. "Master, the water is polluted, and because of this, nothing grows here," they explained. Attentive to the seriousness of the situation, Elisha requested a new bucket with salt. He walked to the source of the river, threw the salt into the murky waters, and prophesied with authority, "Thus says the Eternal, I have purified this water. It will never again cause death nor contaminate the land." And as confirmed by time, the water was purified, and to this day it remains clean, a testimony to the words and power bestowed upon Elisha. At another time, while Elisha was walking to Bethel, a less peaceful incident occurred. Some young men from the city, unaware of the sanctity of his calling, mocked him by calling him Baldhead. Disturbed by this lack of respect, Elisha cursed them in the name of the Eternal. Suddenly, two bears emerged from the forest and attacked the boys, in a tragic outcome to their reckless mockery. Meanwhile, regional politics were in turmoil. After the death of Ahab, the king of Moab rebelled against Israel. In a tripartite alliance, the kings of Israel, Judah and Edom found themselves in a desperate situation. After 7 days of marching, their troops and animals were exhausted and without water. Confronted with the imminent disaster, they questioned, "Did the Eternal bring us here only to fall into the hands of Moab?" It was then that King Jehoshaphat inquired if there was any prophet through whom they could seek divine guidance. An officer remembered Elisha, the faithful disciple of Elijah. "Elisha, son of Shaphat, Elijah's right-hand man, is nearby," he said. Upon this information, Jehoshaphat expressed confidence. "Great, in him we can trust." In that tense time when thirst and despair threatened three kingdoms, the monarchs, the king of Israel, Jehoshaphat of Judah, and the king of Edom, sought Elisha for a miracle. Elisha's reception to the king of Israel was cold, marked by a direct question, "What do I have in common with you? Go consult the prophets of your father and mother." The king of Israel, realizing the gravity of the situation, argued that it was the Eternal who had brought them together in that crisis, not to deliver them to Moab. Moved by reverence for Jehoshaphat, Elisha decided to intercede. "As surely as the Lord of angel armies lives, whom I serve, if it weren't for Jehoshaphat, I wouldn't waste time with you." He then asked for a harpist to be brought. While the soft melodies filled the air, divine power descended upon Elisha, who prophesied a miraculous solution. "Thus says the Eternal, dig ditches in this valley. You won't hear the wind or see rain, yet the valley will be filled with water so that your troops and animals may drink their fill. And this is an easy thing for the Eternal. He will also deliver Moab into your hands. Elisha's instructions promised not only immediate relief from thirst, but also a decisive victory over Moab. You will ravage their land, destroy the fortifications, ruin the cities, cut down the orchards, plug up the springs, and ruin the fields with stones. And so it was that, at the time of the morning sacrifice, water emerged, flooding the valley from the west of Edom, a vision of redemption and power. Meanwhile, in another context of despair, the widow of one of Elisha's disciples sought the prophet, distressed by an imminent threat. "Your servant, my husband, has died," she revealed, "and now the man to whom we owed money wants to take my two sons as slaves." The situation was critical, and Elisha, sensitive to her suffering, asked, "How can I help you? What do you have at home?" Her answer was simple and heartbreaking. "Nothing, just a little oil." Elisha, with his usual wisdom and understanding of divine miracles, instructed the widow in a plan that seemed simple but was laden with faith. "Go around and ask all your neighbors for empty jars and containers," he said. "Don't ask for just a few. Gather as many as you can." Following the prophet's advice, she did exactly as instructed, collected jars from her neighbors, shut herself in with her sons, and began to pour out the small volume of oil she possessed. As each jar was filled, the widow became more amazed. The oil continued to flow against all logic and expectation until all the jars were full. "Bring me more jars," she asked one of her sons. "There are no more jars, mother. We don't have any left," he replied. At that moment, the miracle of the oil ceased. With the jars full, Elisha advised her, "Sell the oil, pay your debts, and you and your sons can live on what is left." Thus, the prophet not only saved the family from slavery, but also ensured their future. The story continues with Elisha and the generosity of the Shunammite woman. Every time Elisha passed through Shunem, he was warmly welcomed for a meal by the Shunammite woman, who soon realized that he was a holy man of God. Moved by this conviction, she and her husband decided to offer more than meals, building a small room for Elisha to rest whenever he passed by. Recognizing the care and hospitality of the woman, Elisha wanted to repay her kindness. Through his servant Gehazi, he asked what he could do for her, offering even to intercede with the king or the army commander on her behalf. The Shunammite woman, content with her life, refused any favor, insisting that she was satisfied with her family and her life. Seeing an opportunity to bless her life even more, Elisha had a divine revelation and announced that within a year she would be holding her own son. Although initially skeptical, fearing disappointment, Elisha's promise came true, and the Shunammite woman gave birth to a son, thus fulfilling the prophetic word. The son of the Shunammite woman, a blessing granted by Elisha, grew up healthy and joyful. However, on a fateful day, while accompanying his father in the field during the harvest, the boy suddenly grasped his head in pain, crying out, "Oh, my head, my head!" Concerned, the father quickly ordered one of his servants to take the boy back to his mother. The servant carried the distressed boy to his mother, who welcomed him into her arms. There, in his mother's embrace, he remained until noon, but unfortunately, he succumbed to his mysterious illness and died. With a broken heart, the mother carried the boy's body up to the room reserved for Elisha, laid him on the bed of the man of God, and closed the door, sealing her grief and hope there. Determined to do something about it, the Shunammite woman sought her husband, urgently asking him for a donkey and a servant to quickly reach Elisha on Mount Carmel. The husband, confused by the urgency outside of a sacred or festive context, questioned the reason. She simply asked him to trust her and not delay with questions. As she set out, she instructed the servant to hasten his pace. Upon seeing her from afar, Elisha, sensing that something was amiss, sent his servant Gehazi to understand the situation. "Is everything all right with you, your husband, and your son?" Gehazi asked. "Everything is all right," she replied, maintaining composure until she stood before Elisha. At that moment, the accumulated strength of her journey collapsed, and she prostrated herself at the feet of the prophet, clinging to him in desperation. Gehazi tried to intervene, but Elisha, realizing the depth of the woman's pain, ordered them to leave her be. "Let her be. Can't you see she is deeply distressed? The Lord has hidden from me the cause of her anguish," he said. The woman then, in tears, confronted Elisha. "Did I ask my Lord for a son? Did I not tell you not to give me false hope?" Faced with the urgency of the situation, Elisha reacted with determination and immediacy. He commanded his servant Gehazi, "Take my staff and run as fast as you can. Do not waste time with greetings along the way, whoever it may be." The instructions were clear: to lay the staff on the boy's face in hope of a miracle. However, moved by unwavering faith and deep sorrow, the mother of the boy insisted, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, you will not leave me behind." Touched by her determination, Gehazi allowed her to go ahead while he followed. Despite her haste and the measures taken, upon arriving and applying the staff on the boy, there was no reaction. The boy remained lifeless. Gehazi returned and informed Elisha that the boy had not responded. Faced with this, Elisha did not hesitate. He went to the house, found the boy dead on the bed, and then, after closing the door and isolating himself with the boy, prayed fervently to the Lord. In a gesture of deep intercession and connection, Elisha lay on the boy, aligning mouth with mouth, eyes with eyes, hands with hands. Under this intimate closeness, the boy's body began to warm. Elisha then arose and walked around the room, an act reflecting both contemplation and a search for yet another divine intervention. He lay down again on the boy, who, to the astonishment and relief of all, began to sneeze, sneezing seven times before opening his eyes, a clear sign of restored life. Upon witnessing the miracle, Elisha called Gehazi and instructed, "Bring the Shunammite woman here." When the mother entered and saw her son alive, her reaction was one of deep reverence and astonishment. She prostrated herself at Elisha's feet, touched by the grace received, before fervently embracing her son. With a heart overflowing with gratitude and joy, she left with him in her arms, a living witness to the power of the prophet and divine mercy. Elisha, always attentive to the needs of those around him, found himself in Gilgal during a time of severe famine. There, while instructing the disciples of the prophets, he recognized the urgent need for sustenance. He instructed his assistant, "Put a large pot on the fire and prepare stew for the prophets." One of the disciples, in an attempt to contribute, went out into the field and returned with wild fruits gathered from an unknown vine, which he mixed into the stew. However, upon being served, the prophets immediately recognized something wrong with the stew, exclaiming, "The food is contaminated, man of God." Faced with this unforeseen circumstance, Elisha was undeterred. He asked for some flour, threw it into the stew, and then ordered it to be served again. Miraculously, the stew was purified by the flour, and everyone could eat without any further issues. On another occasion, demonstrating his gift to multiply not only faith, but also food, Elisha faced a new challenge. A man came from Baal Shalisha, bringing 20 fresh barley loaves and some early ripening figs. Seeing the opportunity to feed many, Elisha ordered the loaves to be distributed to 100 men. His assistant doubted, arguing that it would not be enough, but Elisha, with divine confidence, assured, "Go ahead anyway, the Lord says it will be enough." And so it was. Not only did everyone eat until they were satisfied, but there was also food left over. Naaman, a commander of the Syrian army, was a valiant and respected man, known for his military exploits that often brought victory to his nation, considered divine blessings. However, a serious skin disease marred his illustrious life. During one of his raids into Israel, a young Israelite girl was captured and came to serve in Naaman's household. One day, she mentioned to her mistress that if Naaman consulted the prophet in Samaria, he would surely be cured. Encouraged by his wife, Naaman went to his king, who saw an opportunity for healing, and sent Naaman to the king of Israel with a letter, which brought gifts of 350 pounds of silver, 72 pounds of gold, and 10 sets of fine clothing. The letter explicitly stated the Syrian king's desire for the king of Israel to cure Naaman. The message, however, deeply troubled the king of Israel, who tore his clothes in despair, questioning whether he seemed to have divine powers to heal and give life, interpreting the request as a provocation to conflict. Upon learning of the king of Israel's distress, Elisha, the prophet, intervened, sending word to the king that there was no need for despair and that he should send Naaman to him, demonstrating that in Israel there was a true prophet of God. Naaman then arrived at Elisha's house with great pomp, but Elisha did not personally receive him. Instead, he sent a messenger with simple instructions: go to the Jordan River and dip yourself 7 times. Your skin will be healed and restored. Naaman's initial reaction to Elisha's instructions was one of disdain and anger. He expected a treatment befitting his prestigious position, a personal meeting with the prophet, an impressive ritual invoking the name of the God of Israel, and a healing touch directly on his afflicted skin. The simplicity of Elisha's command to bathe in the Jordan seemed unsatisfactory to him, especially compared to the cleaner rivers of Damascus, Abana, and Pharpar. However, persuaded by his servants who reminded him that he would have done a more difficult task if asked, Naaman reconsidered. "My father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you, 'Wash and be cleansed'?" Convinced by this logic, Naaman went to the Jordan, dipped himself 7 times as Elisha had instructed, and wonderfully, his skin was restored, as pure and rejuvenated as a baby's. Recognizing the power of the God of Israel, Naaman returned to Elisha's house, now with a transformed and humble spirit, declaring his faith, "Now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel." In gratitude, he tried to offer gifts to Elisha, but the prophet firmly refused, affirming his loyalty and service only to the Lord. Naaman insisted, and upon being rejected again, asked permission to take soil from Israel so that he could worship only the Lord, even foreseeing future dilemmas in his commitment to the king of Syria in the temple of Rimmon. Elisha responded to Naaman with words of peace and forgiveness, encouraging him to go in peace. The story takes another turn when Gehazi, Elisha's servant, sees a missed opportunity. Upset by Elisha's refusal to accept Naaman's gratification, Gehazi decided to act on his own. "As surely as the Lord lives, I will run after him and get something from him," he thought, chasing after Naaman. Gehazi, acting on his own, found Naaman, who, upon seeing him running, got down from his chariot to meet him. Asked about the reason for his haste, Gehazi invented a story. 2 young disciples of the prophets had just arrived from the hills of Ephraim and needed help. He requested 35 pounds of silver and 2 sets of clothing, but Naaman, perhaps moved by gratitude and relief from his healing, offered double the requested silver. Gehazi accepted the money and the clothes, hiding them when he arrived home. However, upon returning to the presence of Elisha, the prophet, already aware of what had happened, confronted him. "Where have you been?" Elisha asked. Gehazi tried to deny, but Elisha revealed that his spirit had accompanied Gehazi's act. "Is it a time to accept money and clothes, olive groves and vineyards, flocks and herds, or male and female slaves?" Due to his greed and disobedience, Gehazi was cursed with Naaman's skin disease, which immediately manifested on his own skin. Meanwhile, the disciples of the prophets faced another situation. They sought Elisha, explaining that the place where they were staying was becoming too small for all of them. They suggested going to the Jordan to cut logs and build a larger space. Elisha agreed and even offered to accompany them. During the work, an incident occurred. One of the disciples lost the borrowed axe, which fell into the river. Desperate, he sought Elisha, who promptly asked where the axe had sunk. After indicating the location, Elisha cut a branch, threw it into the water, and miraculously the axe floated to the surface. Elisha then told the young man to retrieve the axe from the water. Amidst escalating tension between Israel and Syria, the king of Syria devised meticulous plans to ambush Israeli forces. However, each of his schemes was thwarted by the intervention of Elisha, the prophet, who informed the king of Israel about the ambush locations. Elisha's ability to even reveal secrets spoken privately by the Syrian king astonished and infuriated the latter, who became convinced that there was a traitor among his officers. When confronted, the officers revealed that there was no treason, but rather divine intervention through Elisha, who knew the secret plans and communicated them to the king of Israel. Determined to capture the prophet, the Syrian king discovered that Elisha was in Dothan and sent a large military force to surround the city overnight. The next morning, Elisha's servant, upon seeing the city surrounded by horses and chariots of war, was terrified. However, Elisha reassured him, ensuring that the divine forces with them were greater than any earthly army. Elisha then prayed for God to open his servant's eyes, allowing him to see the heavenly army of horses and chariots of fire positioned to protect them. As the Arameans advanced to capture Elisha, he prayed again, this time asking God to blind the Syrian soldiers. God answered his prayer, and the Arameans were struck with blindness. Taking advantage of the situation, Elisha approached the disoriented soldiers and, with peaceful cunning, led them straight to Samaria, the heart of Israel. Upon reaching Samaria, the blind Syrian soldiers found themselves in a vulnerable position, completely at the mercy of the king of Israel. After guiding the blind Syrian soldiers to the heart of Samaria, Elisha prayed for God to restore their sight. When their eyes opened, the men found themselves surrounded, not by enemies in an ambush, but by the structure and population of Samaria under the watchful eye of the king of Israel. In that vulnerable and unexpected moment, the king of Israel questioned Elisha, asking if he should kill the prisoners. Elisha's response reflected a compassionate and wise approach. "No, would you kill those you have captured with your own sword and bow? Instead, give them food and water and let them return to their masters." Following Elisha's advice, the king of Israel organized a great feast for the Syrian soldiers. After being well fed and treated with hospitality, they were sent back to their king in Syria. This unexpected gesture of generosity and mercy had a profound impact. As a result, the incursions of Syrian troops against Israel ceased for some time. However, the peace was short-lived. Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, later gathered his entire army and besieged Samaria, resulting in a terrible famine within the city. Food prices soared to exorbitant levels, reflecting the desperation and severity of the situation. A donkey's head, an item considered impure and of little nutritional value, was sold for 80 shekels of silver. And even a simple bowl of vegetables cost 5 shekels of silver, illustrating the severe scarcity and hardship faced by the inhabitants of Samaria. The situation in Samaria had reached a critical point of despair due to the prolonged siege imposed by the king of Syria. On a particularly dark day, as the king of Israel walked on the city wall, a woman approached him in a state of agony, crying out for help. The king's initial response reflected his own powerlessness and frustration, ironically questioning whether he had resources like wheat or wine to offer help. However, spurred by the woman's urgency, he inquired about her problem, leading to a horrifying revelation. The woman recounted a macabre pact she had made with another woman due to extreme hunger. They agreed to sacrifice and eat their own children. The agreement was partially fulfilled. The first woman's son was consumed, but the next day, the second woman hid her son, breaking the agreement. This story deeply shocked the king, who tore his clothes in despair, revealing underneath them a sackcloth, a sign of mourning and penitence. Consumed by anger and helplessness, the king of Israel then proclaimed a deadly threat against Elisha, holding him responsible for the severity of the calamity, possibly believing that the prophet, with his divine connection, could have prevented such extremes of despair. He ordered the execution of Elisha, stating that God would punish him if the prophet's head remained on his neck by the end of the day. Meanwhile, Elisha, aware of the unfolding events and the threat against his life, was meeting with Israel's authorities. He foresaw the arrival of the executioner sent by the king and instructed the authorities to lock the door to protect him. In this moment of tension, while Elisha was still speaking, the king himself appeared, expressing his belief that the calamity was a divine punishment and rhetorically questioning what else he could expect from God. Confronted with the hopelessness and disbelief of the people of Samaria, Elisha, with firmness and conviction, prophesied an imminent change in the fortunes of the besieged city. He announced that within a day, the famine would vanish and food would be sold at low prices in the market of Samaria, a measure of flour or two of barley for a shekel. The disbelief was immediate, especially from the king's personal attendant, who publicly doubted the prophecy, questioning whether Elisha truly believed that God would rain food from the sky. Elisha replied that the attendant would see the miracle with his own eyes, but would not partake in it. Meanwhile, four lepers, marginalized and desperate at the city gate, faced a deadly dilemma: to die of hunger within the walls of Samaria, or to risk themselves in the Aramean camp. Deciding they had nothing to lose, they chose the latter option as dusk fell. To their surprise, upon reaching the enemy camp, they found it completely abandoned. The Lord had caused the Arameans to hear the sound of a great army, including horses and chariots, making them believe they were about to be attacked by a coalition of other kingdoms. In panic, the Arameans fled, leaving behind all their provisions, treasures, and animals. The lepers seized the opportunity. They entered the empty tents, ate and drank to their heart's content, and began to hide the gold, silver, and clothes they found. After plundering several tents, a sense of moral responsibility struck them. Recognizing that it was a great day of victory for Samaria, and that it would be wrong to keep this salvation to themselves, they decided to share the good news with the rest of the city. They emphasized that if they waited until the next morning to act, they could be punished for their omission. Upon receiving the news brought by the lepers, the city gatekeepers promptly relayed the information to the royal palace. Intrigued and cautious, the king of Israel summoned his officials in the middle of the night to discuss the discovery. He expressed his suspicions about the intentions of the Arameans, believing that they might have set a trap, deliberately abandoning the camp to lure the hungry Israelites out of the city and ambush them in the open field. One of the king's advisers then suggested a reconnaissance mission, proposing to send some men on the few horses that were still available to check the situation. The goal was to confirm whether the Aramean camp was indeed deserted or if it was a trap. Following this advice, the king sent two chariots with horses to follow the trail of the Aramean army. The scouts followed the tracks to the Jordan, finding along the way clothes and equipment discarded by the Arameans in their hasty and disorderly flight. The men returned and reported to the king what they had seen, confirming that there was no sign of an ambush, only evidence of a hasty retreat. With the confirmation that the camp was abandoned and safe, the people of Samaria plundered the Aramean camp, finding provisions sufficient to alleviate the hunger in the city. According to Elisha's prophecy, food prices plummeted, and a measure of flour and two measures of barley were sold for a shekel. Unfortunately, amid the euphoria and chaos to access the provisions, the king's personal attendant, whom Elisha had predicted would see the abundance but not enjoy it, was tasked with maintaining order at the city gate. The attendant was tragically trampled by the desperate crowd eager to plunder the camp, thus fulfilling the word given by the prophet. With the exact fulfillment of Elisha's prophecy verified, the events in Samaria served as a powerful testimony to the power of God and the authority of the prophet. The prediction that a measure of flour or two of barley would be sold for a shekel at the city gate materialized just as Elisha had announced. The king's attendant, who had doubted the words of the prophet, saw the prophecy come true, but ironically, met his tragic end by being trampled by the eager crowd, further confirming Elisha's words that he would see divine provision, but not partake in it. Meanwhile, in Damascus, Elisha's narrative continued to unfold in significant events. Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, was gravely ill when he heard that Elisha was in the city. Hoping for an answer about his fate, Ben-Hadad sent Hazael with extravagant gifts, 40 camels laden with the best of Damascus, to consult the prophet. Hazael presented himself before Elisha, questioning on behalf of Ben-Hadad whether the king would recover from the illness. Elisha responded to Hazael with an enigmatic prediction. He informed that, while the king's illness was not fatal in itself, he would certainly die. This announcement indicated a divine revelation that Ben-Hadad's fate was sealed by other means, not by the illness itself. In the dramatic sequence of events described, Elisha, facing Hazael, predicts not only the immediate fate of King Ben-Hadad, but also the dark future that Hazael would bring upon Israel. The moment is intense and revealing, with Elisha fixing his gaze on Hazael until he feels embarrassed, and then the prophet begins to weep. When questioned about his tears, Elisha exposes the atrocities that Hazael will commit against the Israelites, including the destruction of fortresses, the killing of youths, the massacre of infants, and violence against pregnant women. Although Hazael initially shows horror, denying the possibility of such acts with a comparison to a mad dog, Elisha reveals that he will become the king of Syria, indicating that such events would occur under his command. The narrative quickly advances with Hazael returning to his lord Ben-Hadad and lying about Elisha's words. The next day, ominously, Hazael murders Ben-Hadad, using a heavy blanket to suffocate him, thus assuming the throne of Syria. Meanwhile, in Israel, the political plot deepens with Elisha sending one of the prophet's disciples to anoint Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat and grandson of Nimshi, as the new king of Israel. The anointing occurs in a secretive and swift manner. The young prophet finds Jehu among the army officers and leads him to a private room, where he pours oil on his head and declares the divine message. Jehu is anointed king with the express mission of eliminating the house of Ahab, avenging the blood of God's servants and the prophets massacred by Jezebel, and ending the lineage of Ahab, promising a fate similar to that of other corrupt royal families of the past. Jezebel's fate is particularly dreadful, with a prophecy that her body will be left to be eaten by dogs, without proper burial, an end that reflects the extent of her wickedness and the severity of divine justice that Jehu is destined to execute. At the end of his life, Elisha faced an incurable illness. Even in his final moments, the prophet still played a crucial role for Israel, guiding and advising the king. When the king of Israel visited him, he was deeply moved, referring to Elisha with the words, my father, you are the chariots and horsemen of Israel." This exclamation echoed the same lament Elisha had used for Elijah, highlighting Elisha's crucial role as Israel's protector and spiritual mentor. During this visit, Elisha performed a final symbolic act with the king. He instructed the king to take a bow and arrows and perform a ritual symbolizing Israel's ongoing struggle against Syria. With the prophet's hands over the king's, they shot an arrow towards the east, the direction of Syria, proclaiming it as the arrow of the Lord's victory and the arrow of Syria's liberation. Elisha prophesied that the king would fight against Syria until nothing remained of the adversary kingdom. After this, Elisha asked the king to strike the remaining arrows on the ground, but the king only struck them 3 times. Irritated, Elisha rebuked the king for not striking 5 or 6 times, as that would have ensured complete victory over Syria. Instead, the king would only defeat Syria 3 times, thus limiting the success that could have been total. After Elisha's death, he was buried, and his story still held a final miracle. During a Moabite invasion, some men, attempting to bury a body during an attack, hastily threw it into Elisha's tomb. When the body touched the prophet's bones, the dead man resurrected, stood up, and walked out of the tomb. This extraordinary event not only confirmed Elisha's ongoing holiness even after his death, but also served as a testimony to God's power operating through his servant. Elisha remains a central figure in biblical narrative, representing divine power and spiritual guidance, whose legacy and miracles continued to influence Israel even after his departure. The period of the divided kingdoms of Israel and Judah was marked by political turmoil and significant prophetic events. In this setting, Elisha emerged as a prominent figure, a beacon of faith and divine action. Succeeding Elijah, one of the most powerful prophets in biblical history, Elisha took up the prophetic mantle at a crucial moment, symbolized by Elijah's gesture of casting his mantle upon Elisha. This act was not only a transfer of authority, but also a summons to a continuous divine mission. Elisha's legacy is a tapestry of faith, miracles, and challenges that shaped not only the history of Israel, but also the understanding of the relationship between God and his prophets. He not only continued Elijah's mission, but also expanded and deepened the understanding of divine power. His life and ministry exemplify how faithfulness to God can confront and overcome adversities, serving as a model of prophetic service that continues to inspire faith and devotion to this day.